I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Lisa Gibson. Lisa is an attorney, an internationally acclaimed conflict and forgiveness expert, a mediator, and a certified trainer in managing workplace conflict. Lisa is the award-winning and number one internationally best-selling author of The Expert Success Solution, Leadership Lessons Learned from Muammar Gaddafi, and numerous other books. Lisa lost her brother in the 1988 terrorist bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Rather than succumbing to bitterness, she met with and forgave former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, the mastermind behind that terrorist attack. Lisa specializes in cross-cultural conflict resolution and has trained thousands of government, business, healthcare, and nonprofit leaders in conflict-ridden countries. Lisa has been featured in numerous media outlets, including CNN, Fox, BBC, The Wall Street Journal, and The New York Times. Lisa has also received numerous honors, including being chosen as one of 10 outstanding young Americans by the U.S. Junior Chamber of Commerce. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa, you have an incredible background, as well as having a major tragedy occur in your family. One of the things that strikes me about your background is how you have managed to turn a negative situation into a positive one. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that process and not only how you managed to do it, but also the thought process and the feelings that you've gone through as you have managed to take a major tragic event and turn it into something that is helpful and beneficial to so many people.
Well, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting you mention the tragedy, because I think my situation is maybe different than some people, because the loss of my brother not only affected me deeply personally, but it also resulted in a redirection of my entire career for the first 25 years of my life. And so it's been pretty interesting even for me to look back and see how my decision at the age of 18 would end up altering the course of my life and having such really amazing influence around the world. And my brother was killed in 1988, so I was 18 years old when it happened. And it was just like many 18-year-olds, it was kind of a formative time in my life. I was a freshman in college and just starting out and trying to figure out who I am and what path I'm going to take. And during my first year of college, my brother was killed along with 260 other people in what was the worst terrorist attack against Americans prior to 9/11. And it literally was a tragedy that brought me to my knees, into a place of deep despair and soul searching. I was in a deep sorrow for a good year of my life trying to figure out why something like this would happen to me, and not really having the maturity or the internal fortitude to know necessarily how to respond. So I had a choice in trying to figure out what I could do, because I knew I couldn't bring my brother back. But my nature as a person is always about trying to be a change agent, to try to take things and fix them. And maybe that's something that is, you know, sort of a part of a lot of people that are entrepreneur types, is they have vision for something different. And so in my own sorrow and my own loss, I found myself wrestling with, you know, why would something like this happen? So I ended up doing my senior thesis on Islamic terrorism, trying to understand the ins and outs of it and what would compel someone to do something like this. And I ended up, you know, getting a very clear understanding, and that gave me this insight into if the heart of terrorism is hate and fear, maybe the only way to fight it is to somehow walk in the opposite spirit and respond in love and forgiveness. And so that really kind of redirected my path. I knew that if I could find a way maybe to overcome evil with good, it would make my brother's death not be in vain. And so in many ways, at the age of 18, I kind of had a foresight that I could somehow take this tragedy and use it to be somehow a conduit of change and maybe fighting terrorism and preventing like this from happening. But of course, at the time, not really having a clear sense of what that would look like. And so I just started walking this path, kind of fueled by my own faith, that just basically said I must forgive, and trying to figure out how to walk that out. And it took me on this really 25-year journey of seeing doors open into strategic places that I never would have thought. Like you mentioned, having the opportunity to meet with Gaddafi, that was just one of many things that came about out of that tragedy. Is I ended up going on a personal reconciliation trip to Libya in 2004, and it was shortly after the U.S. and Libya began to normalize relations. There'd already been a conviction of Abdelbaset el-Megrahi for the terrorist attacks. So he was serving time in Scotland. And I just reached out to the Libyan ambassador to the U.S., who had just opened the new Libyan embassy in D.C., basically shared with him a little bit of my story, having lost my brother, and said, I want to go to Libya because I want to find a way to focus on reconciliation. And, I mean, I'm saying these things at the time, of course, having really no idea how this is going to happen or what to do, just feeling this very deep compulsion that I have to find a way to transform this loss. And, you know, surprisingly, he actually was very welcoming to me and opened the doors to me to go into Libya. And it was on that trip that I became first envisioned, I guess, to the power of taking something bad and turning it into something good. And when I met the people of Libya, it was, you know, during Muammar Gaddafi's reign, and, you know, they were deeply oppressed. It was well before the revolution that we've seen happen in recent years, and just got glimpses of their story. Many people would tell me things about what their life was like in private because of fear of the secret police or somebody following them, and they call me aside and they want me to know what their lives were like. And I remember hearing for the first time how they were still suffering and not really necessarily understanding that as an American living so far away. And so I realized that maybe the best thing I could do would be to take this loss of my brother and use it to try to be a bridge to reconciliation and helping the people of Libya. So I came back to the United States and was working with a member of Congress who helped me to start the Peace and Prosperity Alliance, which is a nonprofit that was dedicated to doing what we call people-to-people diplomacy, going into developed countries and through relationships, helping them develop. And using the influence that I had as a result of the Lockerbie tragedy to open doors in places that would have normally been closed. I mean, I was the first American Lockerbie family member to go to Libya, but probably one of the first Americans even during that season of sanctions that they had for, you know, 40-some years. And Muammar Gaddafi's son had a foundation, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, who's now on trial for his crimes. But at the time, they were looking at trying to improve their image, and I was able to sort of use the influence and the high-profile nature of Lockerbie to sort of be a bridge. And the doors opened to going in there and serving in a variety of areas in humanitarian education projects and conflict resolution, and then it just kind of continued from there. Even through the revolution, I went in with a team. We drove in from Egypt to Benghazi, which is where the revolution started. And it was on that trip where I was given the opportunity to speak to, you know, a group of probably 100,000 people in a rally in Freedom Square in Benghazi during the revolution. It was actually the day that the International Court issued a warrant for Gaddafi, and they gave me the platform to share about my story, my tragedy, what I've been doing in Libya to try to help the people. And it was just incredibly humbling to me to hear them receive me in such a warm way, that I'd taken my own loss, taken money even from the lawsuit against Gaddafi, and basically gave it back to the people of Libya and helping them. And it's continued even since then. I've been back to Benghazi many times doing training in conflict resolution, leadership development, these kinds of topics. And every single time I go, I'm received very warmly. And I'm given an influence with the people that I wouldn't have had I not walked this out. And it's only in hindsight that I see that the decision I made at the age of 18 has given me a platform to speak into the lives of leaders and different people that I would never have had I not lived this tragedy. And since then, it's expanded from there into other countries like Afghanistan and Iraq and other places that are still deeply embedded in conflict.
Well, Lisa, you've mentioned a few traits that earlier you linked to traits that entrepreneurs often have, this idea of being a change agent, which is something that people in entrepreneurial roles and leadership roles typically want to do. The desire to choose what was a very opposite path from the typical reaction to a tragedy is one that takes, I would imagine, a fair amount of courage to be able to pursue.
Yeah, I think, you know, it is courage, I think at some level. And then at the same time, I think, as I look back, people often say, oh, you're so courageous to meet with Gaddafi or to do these things. And at the time, it wasn't I didn't see it as courage. I saw it as a passion and a conviction that people can really make a difference, that people can change the world. And I think that is something that not everybody has. And it was so deeply, I don't know, birthed in me at an early age that I think that that's what compelled me. So it may be courage at some level, persistence for sure, because there were times where there was opposition or the doors would close. Also maybe a level of discerning situations. I mean, it's almost like having a sixth sense of when to push and when to be patient. And I think part of the challenge for those of us who are kind of visionary or change agent types is knowing when to wait. And it's this idea of being the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I mean, we want to change. We have a sense of it can happen, but sometimes it's knowing that it takes time, and especially when you're dealing in a cross-cultural setting. I mean, I had to build a level of trust with the Libyan ambassador for him to be my advocate and to help sort of assure the Libyan people that I wasn't going to do anything that's detrimental, that my heart and my mission was pure. And so it was being authentic with him. It was being consistent. I mean, on many occasions, he tested me to see whether I was going to change or if I was going to try to be manipulative or some way. And I think that being a woman in some ways helped, you know, because I think sometimes you think women don't have that much influence, but in other ways, he wasn't as threatened by me. And so I was able to come to him in that spirit of humility and service and just say, listen, I just want to help. I want to find a way to help. This is in my own mind the most concrete way I can take this tragedy and turn it into something good. And I think the affirmation for me on this way of doing it came really in December of last year. The BBC did a documentary where they focused on different people who had been sort of weathering this 25 years since Lockerbie and different people's stories, and they featured me in it. And part of that interview included a meeting between me and Ambassador Ojewali, who was a Libyan ambassador to the U.S. during Gaddafi's time and had then, of course, stepped down. And he, for the first time, could be honest with me about things that he couldn't necessarily before because of fear for his own life and his own family. But he shared with me that he was very struck by my willingness to go and to do these things, and he saw my heart, and that I think is what people are looking for, is to build that trust. They need to look through the sort of outside motives to see who you are and your character and your consistency, and I think that's what helped.
Could you share an example of how you were your authenticity was tested and how you responded?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. There were different times where he would ask me questions, Libyan ambassador, for example, in meetings that were really irrelevant to the matter at hand. But I knew they had background checked me. I knew they had vetted me and had some people probably check into my past. So he would ask me questions specifically about things in my past. And one of the things that came up is, you know, I'm a Christian. And so obviously he's a Muslim, and he has some concerns about, you know, maybe I was on some kind of religious mission of sorts. And I said with him authentically, I said, you know, yes, I'm a Christian, but my objective is purely to walk out what I think my faith says, and that's forgiving and focusing on loving my enemies. And the reason simply is because this is what that Jesus said. And so I was honest with him. I could have tried to skirt the issue and act like it had nothing to do with that, but that was the truth. And I think that he respected my heart. And I remember in another meeting with him, another conversation where he was talking about the release of Abdelbaset el-Megrahi, and the terrorist who'd been convicted of the bombing was actually sent back to Libya because he had cancer. And it was very controversial. And he had asked me about that. And he said that some of the other Lockerbie families were upset about that. And he said, you know, he said, Christians are supposed to forgive. And so he basically used my faith, you know, basically brought it back to me again into my face. So I thought it was kind of funny. I said, yeah. I said, well, they're not Christians, so it's okay. But, you know, it's just kind of an interesting thing how he brought that back to me again and in some way, you know, reminded me. And I said, well, that's, as I've always said, that's my motivation. And that, to me, I think it's been really valuable to be upfront and honest from the beginning.
Lisa, you've done a lot of work in the area of conflicts and conflict resolution. What are some of the hard and soft costs associated with conflicts?
Well, I think when I think of conflict, I think that it's been very valuable for me to teach conflict resolution both in a Western context and in a non-Western context, but also in cross-cultural environments, because I don't know that we always realize how much our culture influences how we deal with conflict. And it's only when you step out of your own worldview, your own Western culture, and go to another place and try to teach them how to resolve conflict that you begin to understand that their paradigm is completely different. And so you have to teach in a way that's more of a facilitative approach of helping lead to understanding why maybe the approach that they're taking isn't the most effective. And for example, in honor and shame cultures, in Eastern cultures, in Middle Eastern cultures, even parts of Africa, it's an honor and shame culture where saving face is very important. And so a hard cost with being willing to admit you're responsible for something, or maybe that you were wrong in a conflict, would be you might lose face. And so one of the things I realized was that they apologize differently than we do. They apologize by their actions, not by their words. So they say one thing, but you look at what they're doing, and that's most important. And so that's one thing is you really need to understand that it's going to cost you something, but in the end, it may seem like you're giving up everything by humbling yourself and saying you're sorry in a conflict or taking responsibility or owning some level of culpability, but in the end, it's so much more valuable. And I think that when people look at conflict in the workplace in particular, helping them understand that if you don't resolve the conflict, it's going to cost your business money. I mean, it's the bottom line is it's very quantifiable that conflict costs money to businesses. And if you don't deal with them early on, it ends up just, it's like the ticking time bomb that ends up, you know, getting, you know, louder and louder to the point where it just explodes. And so helping managers and such understand that you have to deal with those early on before it gets to the point where it ends up in some kind of legal action or someone getting fired or having to hire a new employee, and those kinds of things end up costing the business a lot of money.
And do you see forgiveness working the same way in a business context that it does in a political context?
You know, it does. In fact, I wrote a chapter for the Expert Success Solution on helping people to forgive in the workplace, and it comes across to some, you know, maybe business people sometimes as being a little touchy-feely idea, but in reality, it's helping them understand that you can't just mediate around the business issue. I mean, ultimately, in mediation in the workplace, we look at what's the business issue, and we help try to resolve that. But if there's a personal issue that is contributing to the business problem, which honestly is almost always the case, if they don't deal with the personal issue first, and that sometimes it takes time, and it's sometimes very painful to help navigate that as a manager or a mediator, is to help them work through their personal issues. But if you don't get to the root of those personal issues first, help them, lead them to the process of some level of repentance, taking responsibility, and the other person being willing to forgive it, that you'll never be able to resolve the business issue. What ends up happening in most businesses, they just reorganize. They just move one of the staff to another department, or they fire them. And that isn't always the best matter, because sometimes there's, there's still lingering issues with an organization. I mean, we all know in businesses where employees are, you know, they've got their little, you know, different factions of people that support them on issues. And it just, it sometimes causes strife in the overall environment. And sometimes even moving one employee doesn't even solve the problem if you don't deal with some of the trust issues. And so it's going back to how can you reestablish trust? And so although a manager's job shouldn't be a counselor, at some level, they have to understand that as humans, if we can't find a way to move beyond the areas where we think people have, you know, offended us or violated us, then they're not really able to resolve it. And that's the reason we have so much conflict in businesses today.
Lisa, you're someone who clearly lives your life with purpose. When things aren't going so well, how do you maintain focus?
You know, it's interesting for me. I think my grounding probably is most definitely in my spiritual belief. I have to center myself around what I think is most important, because it's easy, even as an entrepreneur or just a business person, to get caught up in the performance and you know, competition and trying to be better than this person. And it's just recentering on who I am and where's my value, and reprioritizing and taking the time sometimes to do that. I just got back from a 500-mile pilgrimage across Spain on the Camino, which is this very ancient pilgrimage that's become very popular in recent years. And it was more of a sabbatical. It was me spending 500 miles of walking time to really figure out what's most important and letting go of certain things I'd focused on and reprioritizing and just centering myself once again. And one of the things that you do on the Camino is you leave these rocks different places, and they kind of symbolize things in your own life that you're choosing to let go of or leave behind, and realizing that that's just baggage that you're carrying if it's destructive to you. And so it was a very healthy and cathartic thing for me to just kind of deposit different coins. And part of it was, even in my own life, is that first chapter of my life focusing on the Lockerbie tragedy is taking that rock and giving myself permission to move beyond that chapter to a new chapter and to see what else I feel called to do and would like to do with my life. And that was hard because there's been such prolific influence as a result of it and so many doors that have opened. But deep within my heart, I needed to let it go, because it was almost like it was defining who I was as a person, and I knew there's more to me than that, and I needed to move beyond that. And so it's giving myself permission to move to another chapter in the book. And I think that's part of it is recognizing deep down who I am and what's important and prioritizing based on that.
Yeah, and in so doing, not only have you helped so many people, but you have also created vehicles that the people have been able to use as guides, such as your books and your programs. And one of the questions that runs through my mind is something that I sometimes hear from people who have gone through a major life-changing event where not only have they shifted their own actions as a result, but also become more centered with their own values as a result, as you have. And they've created, frankly, they've created products and services that, in a business sense, lead to revenue for themselves. And I've come across people who feel conflicted about that. And I'm wondering if that's been a conflict for you or not.
I think early on, I had to have a mental shift that I really did have an expertise from the life that I was living, and that I had something to give back to other people. And I think for me that came about really more, I was, you know, when I wrote my first book, it's a memoir. It's called Life and Death, A Journey from Terrorism to Triumph. And through that book, I share with the reader about how I had to wrestle through personally with this desire for justice, with also this belief that I should forgive, and how should I walk that out and how should I live that. And I realized as I started talking about this and speaking about it in a lot of different venues, the single biggest question people would ask me was, how do you forgive? And I kept thinking to myself, I'm not an expert on this. Like, I'm still living this daily. Like, I'm still daily have to make a decision to forgive people over the most small things, you know? It's like, yeah, I can forgive Muammar Gaddafi, but I can't necessarily forgive my friend who offended me in the situation as easily. So it's just, I didn't feel very, very equipped necessarily to speak to that. But I realized that I had lived a journey and I had walked through something and I was thinking through it and I had come to a realization of how I could personally live this way. And so people would ask me how. And so I wrote the book on basically releasing the chains, how to forgive anyone for anything. And it sounded like a very sort of bold kind of book, but it's not just my story. It includes other people's stories of forgiveness. And people have just come to me and given me a tremendous feedback of how valuable that book has been to them, because I just give them permission to forgive, because it's almost like people don't think that forgiveness is a good thing. Like, they think it's only, you know, the superior people can forgive, and I show them how even the smallest things, making a decision to forgive, has an impact on your personal life, but also in the life of your family, your community, and even the world. And then also helping them understand the detriments of not forgiving, of, you know, the medical effects on your body, of internalizing that, the offense. And it's giving people permission to forgive, but also giving them the skills to do it, and helping them know, how do I get someone to say they're sorry, or how do I get some level of repentance? And sometimes you can get it, and sometimes you can't. I mean, sometimes the person that hurts you isn't even alive anymore, or they're not safe, and so you can't necessarily confront them. Well, what if you can't? Then what's your remedy? And so helping them figure out how to walk that out in light of their own culture, religion, those kinds of things. And I think probably the most concrete example of this, I was in Libya and I was teaching conflict resolution, and I remember a woman came up to me and I had been talking about forgiveness, and she was a doctor, and she was a very stern kind of woman, and she said, I appreciate you sharing your story. She goes, but I want you to know, she goes, that I hate Gaddafi and I hate what he did to these people. And she goes, and every day I see people that supported him walking through the halls of this hospital. She goes, and they may have changed sides. She goes, but I know who they are. And I know what they've done. And then she went on to share about what had happened to her family and the things that they had gone through. And they were horrific things. But then I asked her a simple question. I said, in Islam, in your religion, is God the judge? And she said, yes. And I said, then where's Gaddafi? And she's like, he's burning in hell right now. I said, then why do you need to continue to carry this? And it was amazing to see her whole countenance change, and she softened. It was like she was starting to understand. And I said, as long as you continue to carry this, Gaddafi continues to control you from the grave. And it was like she just had that aha moment. And it was like that very stern woman, you know, started to weep. And I remember just giving her a hug. And I said to her, I know it's going to take time, and you have to, you know, grieve all of that's happened to you. But ultimately, in order to lead this country forward, you need to find a way to forgive.
Lisa, was there any kind of mind shift that you went through when you realized that you the expertise that you have has business value?
Yeah, I think so. Even though I'm an attorney and I'm a trained mediator, I think to me it was connecting the dots between my personal story and my business background and my credentials as an attorney. And what I realized is that this has been probably, for me, the most hard to grasp is, you know, that I could go into a place like Afghanistan, into Herat, for example, which is a very conservative place, and be allowed to teach at a leadership institute where there were almost all men, and there was, you know, one woman in the class, and normally that would never happen, but it was because of my own story and the kind of influence that I'd had a result of it and the high profile nature that it gave me the ability to speak into their lives and to teach them how to resolve conflicts. And it gave me respect that I wouldn't have had. And I recognized that is my credentials took me only so far. But it was when I shared with them my own story of the life that I lived and what I'd gone through and the decisions that I made, that even though as a woman in an Islamic culture as conservative as Afghanistan, that would never be allowed, I was given the ability to speak into the lives of this primarily male class. And I think it spoke a lot. And I remember at the end, the only woman in the class came up to me, and she shared with her what her life was like living there and not being able to drive and those kinds of things, and just living in a very conservative environment. And she said it meant so much to see you as a role model up here, you know, speaking to us and being respected. And she's like, thank you so much for coming. And so I think, once again, it's through experiencing it that I recognize the value of it. And then that kind of fuels me to continue.
Yeah, I agree. I think that getting positive feedback is instrumental to helping one internalize that one has value, and that value can be used in a business context.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, I think it helps to have a strong inner drive. But when I started this out, I never would have thought that I had the capacity to speak to, you know, heads of state or to ambassadors or groups like that. I mean, it was never on my radar. There was something deep within me that kept saying, I know I can make a difference somehow, and maybe I'm not going to transform the whole world, but maybe it's just one person that I speak into their life and the feedback I get from them about how important it is. And I think that's really important for us, is we need to listen and we need to ask questions and we need to be open and not come in with this high and mighty attitude. Like, even going into a cross-cultural environment, like I mentioned, my style of teaching is more of a facilitative approach. I mean, I could stand up there as a Westerner and tell them how to fix their life, but instead I lead them to the answers and they come to those conclusions themselves while they think about, you know, how things work. And that helps, is coming in that place of having some experience, but also just saying, well, what do you think about this? And helping them, you know, teach themselves in a way. And I think that's one of the most powerful things that I've done, is that helps, I think, them feel more empowered, that they can maybe change their circumstances and they can change their life. Because you realize many of these countries are very oppressive. It's like children living in an abused home. And, you know, their dad's been abusive their whole life, and their dad's no longer there. And it's like they're trying to figure out how to live in this new environment. And there are negative forces from all over saying, this is not how we do things here. And they have to figure out how to sort of step beyond those and can try to continue to be change agents themselves. And it's giving them the skills and helping them understand how they can do it. But then they have to make the decision how to implement it in view of their worldview, their culture, and their religion.
Lisa, what are some of the resources that help you when you hit roadblocks?
Well, I mean, honestly, I mentioned, as a Christian, the Bible's foundationally always been my first guidebook. I mean, I look to that for the wisdom that guides my day-to-day life. But I'm also influenced by other resources, just like everybody else. I mean, you know, I love to read Forbes magazine. I love to read Entrepreneur magazine. I need to hear other people's stories to continue in my own path, because especially as an entrepreneur, you're often isolated and feel somewhat shut off from other people. And I need to hear success stories of other people who are shattering the ceiling or breaking through barriers in their own life, who've come from nothing and have made it into something. You know, even though as working in a little bit more of a nonprofit environment, I haven't necessarily done the kind of things that a lot of the people in Forbes do, but I'm inspired by them, and I take the principles that they talk about and I try to implement them into my life. And I think those are the kind of things, I look at role models like that, and that helps inspire me. And it teaches me about different approaches, is being willing to think outside the box and try different things. And if it doesn't work, it's not life-shattering. It's just adjusting and trying something different. And I think that's really important, even working in more of a social, you know, activism kind of area or humanitarian work, is still taking an entrepreneur-type mindset helps continue to fuel you when there is opposition or it isn't happening as quickly as you'd like. Probably one of the most inspiring people that I've had in my own life has been a kind of a inspirational person is a judge. She was the first woman Court of Appeals judge in Mississippi, and she kind of became a mentor. I was at a legal conference, and we shared a room, and I just was inspired by how, when she came out of law school, you know, she couldn't even find a job as a lawyer. She was, you know, the first woman admitted to the Mississippi bar, and how she's just continued to shatter all of those barriers. And so she started out basically as a legal secretary after going to law school. No one would hire her as an attorney. And then she ended up, you know, becoming a court of appeals judge, which is just extraordinary. And so I look to her and people like that, that have continue to persevere in the midst of opposition, in the midst of people saying you can't do that, and just trusting that someday it'll happen. I'm just going to be persistent. And she's, to me, an example of a positive role model.
A very inspiring example. Lisa, what are you working on now that you're most excited about?
I'm actually starting a new project, a new website called fundraisingspeakers.com. And this actually came about as a result of one of my mentors, is an internet marketing coach, Tom Antion. I did this training on doing speaking for nonprofits as a fundraiser to help them raise money. And one of my passions has always been the nonprofit, helping serve nonprofits, helping equip them to do the work that they do. And the challenge is that nonprofits don't have money to pay, you know, the speaker fees. And as a speaker as well, I'm very sensitive to the fact that everyone wants you to speak for free. And so it's a creative idea of enlisting speakers to speak for nonprofits, but in a fundraising model where the speakers agree to basically speak for a percentage of the money that's raised. And it's not necessarily a new idea, although it doesn't happen very often. And so it's envisioning the nonprofits to the value of this model, that, you know, if you bring in a high, you know, profile type speaker, you're going to likely make more money, which will help you. But if you're willing to spread the profits, then they're more likely to do it. And so it's kind of a speaker bureau, and we're starting that out. And I'm actually starting with a group of speakers that have been a part of one of the collaborative book I've done. They're all going to be kind of the first group of speakers, and then we'll just open it up to the world and to get the word out to nonprofits, because in this economy, it's really important for nonprofits to be able to continue to thrive. It's very difficult to raise money now for a variety of reasons, just competing priorities, and just the economy has affected them all. But if you're providing a valuable workshop or a speaker who's teaching on something that may be unrelated to the nonprofit's mission, you're likely to draw a good crowd. And as such, it's a win-win for both groups.
Wow, that sounds very exciting. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Lisa, we're coming close to the end of our interview, and one of the elements that we believe is vital to smash through any plateau in business or life has to do with the community of people around you, which is why we always end our interviews with this question. Who do you know personally that's currently doing work you're especially excited about, and why?
I think for me, it happens to be people that are working in a cross-cultural setting. It's a woman that, her name is Iman Bougagis, and she is her and her husband are both doctors that work in Libya, and they have helped me arrange different projects in that country. But they're both social activists. I mean, they both were leaders of the revolution, of the council that spearheaded the revolution, and Iman was the first spokesperson for that revolution, and she's an activist from her core. And her sister was recently assassinated in Libya, and she was an attorney that was outspoken during the revolution and after the revolution, and was willing to continue to speak despite the efforts to put a, you know, a gag order on her, and continue to advocate for democracy and change. And unfortunately, a couple months ago, lost her life. And Iman, you know, although she's had to leave the country for her own protection because the rest of their family has been threatened, she continues to do the work that she does from remote locations, continuing to be an activist and challenge and encourage people that Libya has got to change. And so she, to me, is one of the best role models of what it is to not give up and to persevere in the midst of opposition, even something as dangerous and life-threatening as losing a loved one and also having her own life threatened. And so she, to me, is an inspiration.
Wow. She sounds very inspirational. Lisa, could you tell listeners how they can learn more about you?
Sure. They can find out more about me at my website at lisargibson.com. And they can also find out more about my books and resources on that website as well.
Thank you. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Lisa Gibson, who is an internationally acclaimed conflict and forgiveness expert, mediator, and certified trainer in managing workplace conflict. Thank you again, Lisa, for joining us.
Thanks for having me, David.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.